This episode, we talk about how airlines use the cloud to provide responsive customer service with Greg Land, IBM's global industry leader for aviation, hospitality, and travel-related services. In the news, we look at Indigo Partners stepping in to invest in WOW Air, micro hotel rooms at the airport, 747 retirements at Qantas, when passengers have to chip in for aircraft repairs, Airbus A320 engine cowling door problems, and Piaggio Aerospace has declared itself insolvent. Also, we have a history segment, the Grumman TBF Avenger. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 530 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight. Joining me is first Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He was the 2008 CFI of the year. He's also an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Max, how you doing? I'm really enjoying some nice winter weather here on the West Coast. I think you can't say the same, though, can you?
Well, today was great, but we have some seriously cold weather coming in.
Burr
for sure. Also with us is David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian who blogs at whatjustflewby.com.
Hey, everybody. Looking forward to having an interesting conversation tonight and breaking news. I wrote a history segment, but don't let that out yet.
That's right. I can't wait. It's been a long time, David. It's overdue, so we'll look forward to that. Well, our guest this episode is Greg Land. He's IBM Global Industry Leader, Aviation, Hospitality, and Travel-Related Services, also Executive Director of Travel and Transportation Global Team. Now, Greg's responsibilities include driving IBM's strategy and point of view for the industry segment, accountability for total revenues and business development, working across all lines of business to support new contract signings for industry solutions, IBM's growth initiatives, long-term services agreements, and successful delivery of solutions and services across this segment. Prior to joining IBM, Greg held leadership roles with American Airlines, Sabre, Wyndham Hotel Group, and Radius Global Travel Management, all that spanning a 23-year travel industry career. Greg has participated and held leadership positions with a number of travel industry associations. He currently represents IBM on the Open Travel Alliance Board and the World Travel and Tourism Council. He also serves on the Thought Leadership Committee for Global Hotel Network and is a member of the IBM Industry Academy. Greg, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Hey, guys. Glad to be here.
You know, Greg, with that background, we could probably talk with you for days, but this episode, we're going to focus on the cloud and how airlines leverage that technology for responsive customer service. So we're going to get deep into the tech, I hope. I think David's a little bit nervous about that, but I think for the rest of us, we're looking forward to that.
Well, it's an aviation podcast. Why wouldn't we talk about clouds? Cirrus, Cumo Nimbus, flying through them, flying around them. I don't understand why I would be completely lost.
All right. It's a geeks podcast, so we talk about geeky things.
That's right. All right. Well, as usual, we're going to kick it off with some of the aviation news from the recent past. So is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
Ready in New York.
From Bloomberg, we see U.S. discount airline Mogul steps in to back Iceland's WOW Air. Max Trescott, seems like we talk about WOW an awful lot these days.
Well, the funny thing is we started talking about WOW soon after I flew them for the first time a couple of years ago when I went to Iceland. And not too long after that, we interviewed the CEO, Skúli Mogensen, way back in episode 379. You just mentioned this is episode 530. In episode 526, so 4 weeks ago, we mentioned that Iceland Air was buying WOW. A few days later, Iceland Air decided they were not buying WOW. So we have the latest version of this story, which is that Frontier Airlines is going to be stepping in to provide some financial backing for the company. So it's kind of interesting. We've got a lot of a lot of different twists and turns to the story.
Yeah, isn't Indigo Partners the, I guess, the parent for Frontier Airlines? But they have holdings in other airlines, Mexico's Volaris and Wizz Air, JetSmart in Chile. And this is no small operation. I see here it's reported that in 2017, Indigo had agreed to buy 430 Airbus aircraft. That was valued at $50 billion. That's list price, I'm assuming. But that's the yardstick. The fate of WOW Air, it seems to shift around. I don't know what it means for travel to Iceland or the strategy that WOW Air has been employing.
You know, I think they're a pretty brash airline. I really have always admired how well they marketed themselves, especially on the internet. They've got a great livery. It's really just kind of a fun color scheme, and they've really seemed to be stealing share away from some of the transatlantic discount airlines. So I've always thought that they were a real mover and shaker, and I'm hoping that this will keep them independent. I would hate to see the WOW name disappear just because they've done so well. Now, I did notice that they were pulling back out of a couple of markets here, a separate story I read sometime in the last couple of weeks. So they're trimming some of the locations. I think there was one on the East Coast and one on the West Coast. So they may have overexpanded a little bit, might be facing a little bit of financial pressure, but my money's on them. I think they will succeed.
Hmm. Greg, maybe you can answer this question. I've always been kind of curious about the low-cost carriers, and do they invest in the back end as much as some of the mainline carriers do, or does sort of the low cost viewpoint strategy extend to their internal operations as well? Any thoughts?
Yeah, so not initially. They typically don't initially. And you look at the low cost carrier model, it's been around since the advent of Southwest Airlines. And it starts out with a business model and an operating model that's all about, common, consistent, and simple infrastructure. Everything from, Southwest started with all 737s. So you don't even have to move the jet bridge. It's quick turn times. Right. And that drives all kinds of efficiencies. Well, same thing with even their IT. They try to keep it as simple and basic as possible, keep the services basic. But as you look at the low-cost carrier model around the world, we now have LCCs at all different stages of maturity in different markets around the world. And they all kind of take that same path where they reach a point where their customer base starts expecting more. And they start increasing services, and that causes them to then have to enhance their IT infrastructure and their IT services and add features to their mobile app and their website. So eventually they kind of start creeping up and closing the gap between both the cost and the services of what a real LCC should be and what a full service airline should be.
Interesting. Yeah, it's kind of a natural evolution, I guess.
Yeah,
fascinating.
And I think we're seeing it in ticket prices. I look at Southwest these days, and boy, they are often not the cheapest, and often by a significant amount. Back in the bad old days, you could always count on that being a cheaper ticket, but not anymore. You got to shop really carefully.
And I guess all that opens the door for new LCCs to come along to replace the old LCCs.
Right.
Yeah, maybe the LCCs become MCCs or something, medium cost carrier or something like that. I don't know.
Hey, bottom line, it gives the consumer a choice, right?
Yes, which that's always the objective. All right, next item comes from USA Today. Sleep Box Micro Hotel set up open at Washington Dulles International Airport. Now, I don't know. Have you ever wanted some place to sleep for a few hours at the airport that was maybe more comfortable than the seats in the boarding area? Boy, I have, that's for sure. Well, you'll have that option soon on Concourse A of Dulles International Airport at the Sleep Box Nap Lounge. Now, this is, it's almost exactly what it sounds like. It's post-security, little tiny standalone, soundproofed rooms. In the case of Sleepbox, no bathrooms or showers. And you can rent these either through their website or the Sleepbox app. You can rent them for an hour or more or even overnight. Now, these are small. I mean, they're 8 feet tall, but the room size comes in two sizes, a 30-square-foot room, that's the compact size, and a 45-square-foot room, that's the, quote, standard size that has more storage space. So, I don't know. What do you guys think? I mean, there are others that do this. Minute Suites is in a few areas. The Sleepbox offering here seems maybe a little bit more Spartan than what Minute Suites offers. But I don't know. To me, it just seems like a great idea when you've got these layovers that, you know, where you'd really like to take a nap.
You know, this reminds me so much of the Japan hotel pods or the capsule hotels that they have over there. And I was thinking, well, it only took 40 years for the idea to come here to the United States. I mean, a lot of those are actually quite a bit smaller. You know, the ones that I'm thinking of, yeah, they're often stacked too high and you certainly can't stand up in them. Yeah, there are some that you can stand up in, but by contrast, these things look huge, but then that's kind of how we seem to do things in America. It's like, well, let's take this little idea and let's make it larger, but it's, you know, it's a room. You can stand up here and the ceilings are high. It looks pretty darn comfortable.
I don't know. I'll take your word for it.
You're not going to sleep at the airport, huh, David?
Well, it's tough to imagine me crawling into a Japanese rest cube or this at 6'4", you know, and all legs. So they're not designed for me. They're designed for the general public.
So there's hourly rates in the case here for the compact room, $25 an hour, the standard room, the larger one, $35 an hour. The overnight stays, 12-hour overnight stays are capped at $120 and $150. So that's not too bad. The Minute Suites offering $42 for a 1 hour, that's the minimum. I'm not sure why you'd want a room for less than an hour. Overnight rate, flat hours, eight hours. Flat rate for 8 hours, $155. You pay extra for the shower, the Minute Suites, I guess, in some locations. Dallas-Fort Worth and Charlotte, I guess, have a shower available. That's extra, $30. It's a little bit more. I think there's more space in the Minute Suites room, more of a place to work as well. But they're soundproofed. In the case of Minute Suites, they say a sound masking system within each suite helps neutralize noise to help deliver a refreshing power nap. And I'm thinking, wow, that could be a good way to also podcast from an airport. Nice and quiet.
Max, I'm glad this is a PG podcast, because when you said, why would you want a pod for less than an hour? My thoughts went to certain things. And then you brought up soundproof, and I'm like, okay, this is just, how big are they?
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a missed opportunity here, and I'm sure this will be the next evolution in this. I'm thinking, kind of think about the container ship industry. You know, these things look like they're, you know, smaller than a container. I would like to rent one of these things, and while I'm in it, they load it onto the airplane, and I show up at my destination. I think that's the travel way of the future.
Max, does that not sound like what we talked about on Thursday's UAV Digest?
Yeah, it does. It does.
We talked about containerized taxis where they would transfer the container from the car to the airplane.
Yeah. There's a developing concept with Audi and some others where a self-driving automobile with basically a removable pod would get picked up by, with you in it, would get picked up by a drone, basically, to fly you to your final destination. So, yeah, that's not too far off from that.
You know, when I saw this story, what came to my mind was it's kind of a service that competes with some of the new lounge aspects.
Yes.
All the airlines are up in their game when it comes to customer experience. They're all trying to differentiate on customer experience, and that includes their lounges. So almost all the major airports the lounges are being completely renovated. And in most cases, they have sleep rooms and showers and quiet spaces and all that. And a day pass for most of them runs anywhere from $40 to $50. So for the price range for these pods, you could almost just get a day pass and you get your food and your beverage and your free Wi-Fi and all of that in one of the airport lounges. And then you've got American Express getting into the lounge business and a lot of hospitality companies getting into the lounge business. So I think it's interesting that they're offering this as an alternative to just buying a day pass for one of the airport lounges.
Yeah, good point. Well, yeah, we'll see how they compete. Boy, you know, airports have really changed over the years. It seems like in the old days, quote unquote, you know, the airport was, you know, you arrived, you just sat for not too long, got on your plane, that was it. But now with all the services, all the amenities that you find at airports, the shopping, just the whole experience is really
changed. It's now a shopping mall that just happens to have airplanes parked at it.
Yes, exactly. All right, well, let's move on. There's an article from Airline Geeks, not Airplane Geeks, but airlinegeeks.com. Qantas flies final Boeing 747 service from Los Angeles. Oh, boy, those Qantas 747s going across the Pacific, those were always a treat. But Max T, looks like we're going to lose that service, at least from Los Angeles.
They are a treat. And of course, I think I mentioned that's what I flew to Australia on a couple of weeks ago, 747. And even the flight attendants talked about how much they loved those airplanes. Fortunately, they are still going to be in service here from San Francisco, though the timeline I've heard from the flight attendants was 18 months. And here it says in the article that the airline plans to fully retire the fleet in 2020. So that kind of lines up with what I've heard. So in the future, you're going to have to fly out of other destinations like San Francisco to get a ride on a 747.
But as for Qantas, I guess they're really shifting to the 787-9 Dreamliners as well as the Airbus A380s. Qantas has been around for a long time, I guess 98 years. They've been a huge customer of those 747s. I remember the first time I flew one of those, where did I go? To Sydney. The flight attendants struck me as being of a completely different sort than what I was used to, well, on United or JAL or ANA. It was like having a lot of butlers on the plane. Now, this was some time ago, so I'm not sure what it's like now, but it was a different experience.
I wanted to make sure I wasn't awakened, you know, for dinner. So I put a little sign in my pocket that said, you know, don't wake for dinner. And as I was getting off, one of the flight attendants said, and we all really liked your little sign. So that was kind of a cute personal touch. Yeah, they had as many as 65 of these. That's just a phenomenal number. And now they're down to 9. Obviously, the economics are forcing them to all be mothballed, which is too bad. And it's pretty soon that era will be over. I love those planes, and that's going to be sad to see them all go.
Yeah. David, I guess we have some other kinds of retirements happening these days as well, don't we?
Yeah, this is one of we lost two aircraft that I grew up watching all the time. Canada retired their Sea Kings this week, the CH-124s. They've been flying them around since 1963, which is kind of a sad loss. They're being currently replaced by the Sikorsky CH-148 Cyclone. If anybody knows what the Sikorsky S-92 is, it was the helicopter Sikorsky designed for the original Marine One mission. But that when that fell apart, Canada decided to take delivery of those and refurbish them and replace the EH-101s, which is originally what they were supposed to get. The other really sad event is Australia retired their AP-3Cs, Orions. So that's another legacy aircraft that I grew up watching at Willow Grove go by. They're being replaced by the P-8 Poseidon. So it's two legacy aircraft of similar vintage as the 747s being replaced in the military. You know, it's sad to see these aircraft that we grew up going they're never going to go away, you know. And so it means we're all getting old.
That's what I was going to say, David. That means we're getting old. Oh, dear. All right. Well, moving on. You know, I recall in the past some stories, some accounts of things like a commercial flight landing in some place and needing to refuel, and there having to be a cash payment in order to buy the fuel at that particular location, and there being problems there. But this is a similar yet somewhat different kind of a situation, Max, with LOT Polish Airlines.
Yeah, apparently they had a situation recently where they had to ask their flyers to help pay for repairs to the airplane. So
that's great.
They were in Beijing, and they needed to fly to Warsaw, but they needed a new pump, and so they turned to the 249 people on the plane to pass the hat. So apparently they raked in the $350, and the flight had a $10 delay. And the people who lent the money got paid back, I guess, when they reached their destination. But still, it's kind of a head shaker. I've never heard of crowdfunding airplane repairs before.
Well, and hopefully United isn't listening to this.
Oh, dear. Well, in this people.com article, there's a quote from someone who just simply is described as being on the flight. And he said, "We are at an international airport. I cannot believe that transactions take place here in cash under the table with the mechanics standing next to the plane." So, the airline wasn't really thrilled about this. They commented that the airline provides funds to solve problems like this. And they say there are no circumstances that justify asking money from passengers. So, Greg, that's got to be the ultimate of the bad passenger experience.
Yeah, really. Well, and when I look at this article, I wonder, you know, it wasn't so much about the economic status of LOT Airline, and probably had to do more with the airport they were at and the process you have to go through. But I mean, the whole point of line maintenance is the fact that airlines loan each other parts and, you know, borrow parts when they're having to make last minute fixes like this.
Right.
Because you're not going to have a full inventory, you know, at every airline station around the world. So, I thought this was interesting. This is not the typical protocol.
No.
For line maintenance. Definitely not. So
could be the wave of the future, but I think you have a point there.
Could it clearly there was a lot. They had a lot on their mind and a lot of life.
Oh, no. Oh, David. We can't get through an episode without David. All right. Well, you know, there was some other aircraft flying around needing repairs. ABC Action News reports Frontier flight bound for Tampa forced to return to Las Vegas Airport after engine cover rips off. And this is from a few days ago, November 30th. The number two engine cowling on a Frontier flight from Las Vegas to Tampa let go. Now, the engine, the CFM56, kept operating. Doesn't really need engine cowling to operate, I guess. But there were no injuries. This was on an A320. The photo that was posted on Twitter by someone really clearly shows the cowling doors. When I saw this, before I read more of the explanation, said to me, somebody didn't fasten those doors down.
I agree. I think that's probably the most common cause of these problems.
Now, there's something called Aviation Safety Network. They're at aviation-safety.net. And they talk about the number of fan cowl loss events involving Airbus A320 family aircraft since 1992. And they say there have been a lot of them. This says that in July 2015, the UK AAIB published an investigation report into fan cowl door loss accident involving an Airbus A319. prior to this May 2013 accident, there were a total of 34 previous occurrences of fan cowl door loss on Airbus A320 family aircraft, including 21 events for aircraft fitted with IAE V2500 engines and 13 events for aircraft fitted with CFM56 engines. They go on, following the A319 accident, three further instances of fan cowl door losses occurred, bringing the total number of occurrences to 38. And then say ASN was able to trace 29 occurrences, of which seven after the publication of the AAIB report, bringing the total to at least 45 occurrences. And clearly there's an issue. One of the looks at this has come from the University of Limerick, actually. And just last month, in fact, on November 13th, 2018, they published a report. And they have a video. We'll put the video in the show notes so you can see that. And they have a very interesting little diagram that shows the difference between, well, aircraft A, which is basically Airbus, where the latch for the fan cowl doors is on the underside of the engine, whereas on aircraft B, which has the distinctive shape of a CFM56 on a Boeing 737, the latches are not at the low point. They're a little bit off to the side. So I think what they're saying here is that this design isn't really taking into account maintainability and inspectability. It's very difficult to get to the latches, and it's difficult to ensure that the latches are in fact latched. So whereas when you look at something like this and you see the picture and you think that, well, okay, someone didn't latch the cowl doors, is it really the fault of the individual, the mechanic, or is it really basically a design issue around this? And I think I agree with the University of Limerick folks that this is, it's not a great design.
And the thing about cowling incidents, I can't remember any where there was a significant problem. Usually the engine continues to operate fine. But I did, in the deep back recesses of my mind, remember one where it actually led to a shutdown of a different engine. Years ago, I met a National Airlines pilot in the late 70s, and he told me that he had been one of the, the member of the flight crew for a National Flight 41 that left, Miami. Shortly after takeoff, they lost one of the cowlings, and guess where it ended up? It's a DC-10.
Yeah.
Oh. It ended up in the tail engine.
Yeah, the number
so
two engine.
So it came off the left wing, and it flew back into the engine in the tail. So they had to shut that engine down, and he landed safely at Tampa International with no injuries. But that was one of the few where I remember that losing a cowling caused, another problem.
Yeah, amazing. All right, one final story. I think our favorite airframe manufacturer on the show is Piaggio Aerospace. We've talked about the beautiful twin pusher aircraft that they produce. David, we talked about this on the UAV Digest last episode too, but we have some sad news, don't we?
We do. It wasn't just our favorite aircraft, but then it became our favorite drone when they decided to convert it to a drone. But it looks like Piaggio has filed for bankruptcy, which is unfortunate. It's Italy's oldest aviation company, and I don't think it's going to be picked up. And it's just unfortunate. We've always been fond of that aircraft and the family of aircraft, and it's unfortunately we're losing another manufacturer, especially ones that design really pretty airplanes.
Yeah. They've had some investment from the Middle East. They had the prospect of the military orders for the drone, the Hammerhead. The Italian government, I guess, is not in the greatest financial shape right now. It is Italy, after all. The business, the volume of business for Piaggio just hasn't been there. So I guess it's always possible that someone will step in and provide some financial support, but a lot of money has flowed into Piaggio in the recent past, and I don't know if that will continue or if this will be the end. Piaggio is an old company, something like 100 years, David. Do you recall?
Yeah, they were the primary bomber producer in World War II for the Italian Air Force, believe it or not.
Oh.
The Piaggio produced a four-engine bomber that was superior than most of the German bombers that were of that class. Kind of looked like a B-17, but they've been around a really long time, and we're losing an old-school European aircraft airframer.
And we have a Piaggio based at my airport in Palo Alto, one of these sleek twin-engine turboprops. And that thing is gorgeous. I've gone inside of it. I think it's about a $7 million airplane. And it's like going onto a luxury yacht. It's just all polished mahogany in the back. And you can tell that clearly, you know, one of the strengths of this manufacturer is the kind of the luxury interiors that they put in these airplanes, not to mention, you know, a really sleek, cool-looking airplane on the outside. So, yeah sad to hear these folks have gone bankrupt. But I would imagine that someone's going to pick up the support of these aircraft, because otherwise they're going to be orphans, and that would be a shame.
All right, let's move on to our main topic. Again, we're speaking with Greg Land from IBM. Greg, again, welcome to the show. It's
thanks, guys.
Yeah, this is a great opportunity. You know, we all talk about the cloud. We hear about the cloud. I think we probably all have a definition in our head of what the cloud is, but let's just sort of baseline everybody and describe, what does that mean in this context? What does it mean from an airline's perspective, from the passenger perspective? Tell us what the cloud is.
Well, let me step back and just kind of set the stage or kind of the state of the industry, and then I'll go in to answer that question, Max. Because if you look at the state of the airline industry right now, in commercial aviation anyway, everybody's trying to differentiate based on customer experience, as we were talking about earlier. And so a big driving force behind that is all of their strategies around digital transformation. And what that means is converting all of your business processes to where they're supported by digital systems, digital platforms, which means you can then interact electronically, both with your customer as well as across the employee base. So to do that, there were three big hurdles. Number one, they had to modernize all their core systems, their flight ops systems, their reservation systems, everything around the passenger sales and service platforms. Then they had to get their arms around all the data. And then they had to really look at how that data then integrates with all these new digital channels, whether it's mobile or website or something like that. And so to do all of that, to host all that stuff in mainframe systems or premise-based servers, you're going to spend a ton of money on hardware on top of hardware on top of hardware, because the volume of data and the types of data just keeps increasing that they're capturing, whether it's from sensors on an aircraft or new data attributes they capture in how they engage with the consumer on a mobile application, for example. So all that being said, what cloud means is cloud is just a way of saying, instead of having everything hosted in big mainframe servers or premise-based hardware at my location or at my own data center, I'm sharing a data center with a bunch of other people, and a third party is hosting those systems for me. So when we say the cloud, it really means that you've got the economies of being hosted in a data center where somebody else is taking care of disaster recovery and backup and all of that, and you're getting the economies of scale by having everything hosted somewhere else offsite, and you're just accessing it through the network.
And that takes a lot of the burden off of maintaining your own IT infrastructure, which, I mean, if you're an airline or an airport or some other business like that, that's not your core business.
Right. And so in the early wave of cloud computing, it was really about just lifting that burden of infrastructure off of your local facilities and having somebody else host that for you. So it was, the early wave was really just about basic IT efficiencies and keeping the cost low. And as you guys know, you know, airlines operate on pretty thin margins to begin with. They have huge capital expense just maintaining the fleet and upgrading the hardware they fly in the sky. So any kind of efficiencies they can get with the hardware on the ground, meaning the IT hardware, it just benefits the whole business model of an airline. So so that was the early wave, was just looking at the IT efficiencies you get from having somebody else host these systems for you.
So now is it a matter of an airline saying, hey, now that we've got this, look what we can do?
Yeah. So if you think about that at the basic level, it's really about then taking that IT efficiency and leveraging it for scale and stability. Because, you know, airlines get beat up over every little thing, right? I mean, every week there's something in the news. So the last thing you want to have is have your systems going down, especially your customer-facing systems, whether it's your reservation system or your website or your mobile app. And you think about it, I mean, you guys probably travel like I do. You become pretty dependent on that airline mobile app, mobile check-in, pick your own seat, getting updates about departure times and gate changes and things like that. You have all that right in the palm of your hand. So if that goes down, it kind of disrupts your whole day if you're traveling. Hmm. So what that does then is it allows you to scale those systems, have multiple versions of it based in data centers around the world, so you have contingency built in. And so that's one of the things we did with American Airlines about a year ago. We moved all of their customer-facing applications into our cloud. They now have a replication of those applications around the world. So if I'm accessing the AA app and I happen to be in Southeast Asia somewhere, I'm probably pinging a data center somewhere over in that region, not going all the way back to the US or back to Dallas, Texas, to where it's hosted at their data center or something like that. So it also can create improved performance as well, even for the user that happens to be accessing that application, whether it's a traveler or an employee of that airline.
Do airlines have the difficulty introducing their app and their online capabilities to their customers, or do the customers are they so used to this sort of thing anyway that they're demanding it of the airlines? Which way is it kind of flowing?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, airlines were probably the first ones across travel and transportation to really jump on board with this type of application. You think about how long we've been able to do mobile check-in. Hotels have just started offering that in the last 3 years. And you know, we're not even talking about, you know, cruise lines and other aspects of travel. So airlines have had it out there for quite a while. So they're starting to get earlier and earlier adoption from even new flyers, because we've all become more comfortable with mobile apps on our phone for a variety of things, right? Hmm. And so even if you're not a weekly traveler or a road warrior, for business travel, and maybe you only take a couple trips a year, you're still pretty comfortable with handling transactions, shopping and purchasing and things like that on your phone, on the mobile app. So adoption hasn't been the big issue. And if you look at the progression of self-service tools from an airline, they kind of started with kiosks at the airport. And once we all got comfortable checking in ourselves and printing our own boarding pass, then they moved that functionality to their website. And they said, okay, all those things you could do on the kiosk, start doing that before you leave home. And then now they've just gradually moved that same functionality to the mobile app. And so you kind of have that progression of user going from kiosk, getting comfortable there, to the website, to then doing all those things on the mobile app when you're out and about or on your way to the airport even.
Hmm. Are the airlines developing these mobile apps internally, or are they outsourcing that as well?
You know, it's a variety of things. We entered into a partnership with Apple 4 years ago, and we found that the design methodology with Apple was really beneficial for us in developing some of these apps for airlines and other companies across the travel industry. It's just because everybody's so comfortable with the iOS applications. They're very intuitive, and the Apple design methodology was also something that translates into apps for the employees as well. So yes, we help the airlines with their websites and their mobile apps for the consumer, but a lot of what they're focused on now, they've got such high adoption from the traveler. We're now shifting to doing the same thing for their employees. And I mean pilots, flight attendants, both above the wing and below the wing services, ground handling, baggage services, things like that. Because the other thing that cloud does for us is all of this data, whether it's operational data or customer data, once you host that in the cloud, it then makes it readily available to be used across the enterprise and to integrate down to a mobile application in real time. So if I'm, let's talk about the flight attendant scenario. Now that a good number of carriers have air to ground Wi-Fi connectivity, they can now connect a mobile app that's in the hands of a flight attendant to all their systems on the ground. And their systems on the ground are now modernized and potentially hosted in a cloud environment as well, so readily accessible by this mobile app. So we've got mobile apps out with several airlines now where the flight attendant can actually, it's an iPad app with the same type of functionality we're used to with alerts and pop-up notifications and things like that. So once you take off, if the flight attendant gets a notification popped up on his or her iPad that says, Mr. Land in seat 21A is not going to make his connection at DFW. The flight attendant can actually come back to my seat, deliver the bad news, but also have a solution right there and say, I have these connecting flights with availability. I can confirm you, pick a seat, and push you a new boarding pass right here.
Wow.
So think about how that changes the passenger's life. I'm sitting on a 3-hour flight. I realize I've missed my connection. I can sit there and stress for 3 hours, bolt for the door and run to the customer service counter, or I can have this type of service in the air and sit there and enjoy the rest of my flight and know that I'm confirmed on the next flight and I already actually have my boarding pass on my phone. So it's really, that's the kind of thing that when we say responsive customer experience, that's the type of thing where cloud merging with data and mobile is what's really transforming the customer experience aspect of travel.
Are there privacy and security issues associated with this new capability? I mean, all the time we see somebody is hacked into, and are these things secure from that standpoint?
Yeah, cloud definitely has security aspects to it. Mobile does as well. We have to stay on top of that and continually improve that because the hackers just get more and more sophisticated as well, as we all see. And so there's the security is there, but I think from the user perspective and the privacy of personal data, just like with any other feature on a mobile application, the traveler has to opt in for this type of benefit. But the thing we've seen is, especially in the travel aspect, that the traveler feels like so much of the whole process is out of their control. So anything you can put in their control, they tend to adopt it pretty quickly. And going back as far as 2009, one of the very first mobile apps that we launched in the aviation industry was with Air Canada. And in 2009, we added the functionality for irregular operations, or what an airline calls IROPS, where if you had already opted in to their mobile app and you were an Air Canada loyalty member, you kind of got first mover's rights. If your flight was significantly delayed or canceled, you got a notification pushed to your phone and it already knows the context of your itinerary and it knows, and it pushes you a notification that the flight's been canceled. And back then, in many cases, you were getting a notification before the gate agent even announced the flight was going to be canceled. And literally with six clicks on the iPhone app, you could pick from a list of next available flights, pick your seat, confirm, and have your new boarding pass. And in many cases, before the gate agent even announced the flight was canceled. So you also get these first mover's rights. You got first dibs on that next flight before it gets booked up from this canceled flight. So the road warrior and frequent travelers, they see the benefit. They opt into this stuff. And unless they see some really severe risk, the adoption has been pretty high, even on these types of alternative services through the mobile app.
Okay, I've got a question. I want to also acknowledge to my co-host that he brought up Apple. I didn't. So security, what is the biggest challenge going forward? I guess all of this early opting in, I actually have the Air Canada app that you talk about. How do you get the technology to the point where someone who flies only once a year or once every other year to adopt that technology?
Yeah, no, and that is tough. And that is tough. And that's why you see a lot of airlines trying to add additional services and other travel providers as well. Hotel companies, car rental companies, they're all looking for a way to get you to not delete that app and to keep that app on your phone. So, for example, United has their Mileage Plus X application now where you can spend miles for retail and other things like that. And they want you to come back through the United app to shop for other things that you can redeem your Mileage Plus miles on. So they're all looking for, you know, stickiness to get you to keep that mobile app on your phone and get you to log in more frequently. Now, a lot of times, even if you're only flying a couple times a year, if you are a member of the loyalty program, you maybe at least go in a few other times a year just to check your balance or look at how many more miles you need for a particular flight or something. But they're looking for bigger plays beyond that. And, you know, they're all looking at both for their mobile app and their websites to expand the type of content they have and start providing destination content and start providing, you know, the path to book excursions and other travel services through their apps because they want you to keep coming back. But yeah, that's probably one of their biggest challenges as far as adoption is that less frequent traveler or somebody who's not a loyalty member. Because typically, think about it, you know, if I'm going on a vacation and I happen to be staying at a Marriott resort, but that's going to be the one time this year I stay at Marriott, I maybe download the app for that trip. But then once that trip's over, as soon as I need that space on my phone, I'm probably going to delete it. So they're all looking for ways to get you to keep coming back to that app so you don't delete it off the phone.
Hmm. Yeah, and when we look at the entire travel experience, in many cases, of course, Greg, it's more than just the airplane flight.
Yeah.
Rental cars, hotels, like you described, destinations for vacations and things like that.
Well, wait, don't forget TSA as long as we're talking about the airline experience.
Well, yeah. The airport experience.
It's part of the experience. Well. Yep.
Exactly.
Yeah. Are we just at the beginning of a process of integrating those things, or are they developing sort of as islands of capability? What does it look like right now?
Well, you know, more so than ever, those travel providers across the travel supply chain are talking to each other more than they ever have before. You know, in the past, you maybe had a marketing relationship between a hotel and an airline, but it was strictly in the context of their loyalty program.
Yeah.
But now we're looking at scenarios where they actually want to connect to be able to pass customer information back and forth, maybe even have the context of the broader itinerary. Because if you look at what's really right from the passenger's perspective or the traveler's perspective, it's, you know, it's not just when you board my airplane and leave my airplane. It's when you leave your house and when you return to your house. Right?
Yeah.
So they're all looking for ways to expand their influence now that they've moved to these digital capabilities and they have these digital channels where they can have an ongoing dialogue with the traveler, which is what they really want. And that goes back to the point about keeping the mobile app on your phone as well. They're all looking for ways to get up that curve to where they have an ongoing dialogue with you well before you board the airplane and well after you leave the airplane. So they're starting to look at these what we call ecosystems, and you're going to start seeing alliances expand beyond just the alliances in the loyalty programs and look at how they can interface to share customer information. And I'll give you an example. And this is a real life use case that we've actually got some clients talking to us about. You've got an airline. You've got an irregular operation scenario where my flight has been canceled. It's late at night. Everybody's scrambling to find a hotel room. But maybe my destination is only a 2-hour drive away. And maybe I could just as well be served by having the airline offer me a discount on a rental car. But they want to make sure they're offering a hotel option or a rental car option that fits my personal preferences. So if they had the ability to link up with some hotel partners and some rental car partners, and that happens to be one that I'm also in their loyalty program, they could push back through the airline app when they have to tell me my flight's been canceled that night. They could say, well, we can get you on the flight tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., but if you'd like to drive the additional 2 hours, we can also offer you this discount on a rental car, or we know you're a loyal Marriott member. Here's three Marriott hotels within the area that we know have availability. Because if they're interfacing the platforms across those different travel providers, they've already pinged Marriott. They know your preferences. They know your loyalty information for Marriott. And they know which hotels actually have live inventory available right then to offer you. So we're starting to see these ecosystems form where these partnerships are going beyond marketing partnerships, and they're becoming technology and data sharing partnerships. But like we said before, you're going to have to opt into these things because we're talking about sharing personal customer data between providers now. So it's going to take a while for some of this stuff to develop. But I think more so than ever, the serious travelers and the road warriors, as I call them, I think they'll embrace this kind of stuff because, it's miserable to have to stay somewhere overnight when you're not expecting to. And if I'm connecting, in DC back from Europe and I just have to get that last leg up to New York, I can just as well go over and catch a train and be home in 2 hours if they can offer me an option on Amtrak. So it'd be nice to be able to push all those options back through the mobile app and keep it within the context of that self-service application.
Well, I can envision different segments of the travel industry employing different providers of cloud services. And is there some kind of data interchange standard or something? How do these systems talk to each other?
Yeah, so a couple of things there, because that is the other big value proposition with cloud in the aviation industry, is being able to share data, not even just, between travel partners like what we were talking about, but even across your enterprise. Because when you start looking at all the data that is being aggregated, it's just not physically efficient to keep that in hardware-based servers. So it makes more and more sense to aggregate that data in the cloud, make it readily available to be integrated back into mobile apps in real time, but especially when you look at employee applications, like the flight attendant application I was talking about, or a baggage handling application, things like that. And that's some of the work we did for Lufthansa Airlines, is we aggregated a lot of their customer data into a cloud-based database that then was able to be integrated in real time to a lot of these employee apps that we're rolling out to their employees at the airports in the field to give them ready access to this customer data. And that also translates to an improved customer experience, because think of a scenario where if I'm flying from JFK to Munich, as soon as the flight takes off from JFK, if my bag didn't get put on that aircraft, they know immediately. So why should I land in Munich, go to the carousel, wait for the carousel to be completely depleted of all the bags to realize mine's not there? Why not have a baggage service agent meet me, find me in the baggage claim area, or even meet me as I'm coming off the airplane to tell me my bag isn't here? So if you've got all this data being put as an enterprise database where it can be accessed globally by those different airline employees, those types of applications become possible. So that's one big aspect of it. But then you talk about systems talking to each other. There's a couple of different classifications of cloud. There's public and private cloud, there's hybrid cloud, and then there's multi-cloud. And so when you talk about multi-cloud, that's when you've got different types of systems trying to talk to each other. And so to manage that, that's where we've moved to what's called open source. So you've got one system on Linux, one system on Java-based code, and you want them to talk to each other. And so we've, on the IBM cloud, we've embraced open source, And you may have read here recently, we acquired a company called Red Hat.
Yes.
And the reason we acquired Red Hat was because they have the leading open source APIs in a hybrid cloud environment. So that's going to really enhance some of the functionality we already have in the IBM cloud today. And when you think about an airline, the legacy systems, they may have some systems now in public cloud, some systems in private cloud. You're talking about definitely a multi-cloud environment, but then you start having to communicate with a hotel company or a car rental company or somebody else in your ecosystem. That's where open source is going to be critically important, because then you could pull in data from a hotel partner or somebody like that. And even if they're on a totally different type of system, by having these open source APIs that are already sitting in a cloud-based portfolio, it makes that type of integration very possible and definitely much more easily done than before.
I was just curious, we were talking about Lufthansa, and in my former life, privacy was a big deal. But how is the EU's standard on privacy? Because what triggered it was the whole opt-in, opt-out situation. It's kind of interesting that, how does that affect you? You have to model that, or using that as your standard for the rest of the world, since it seems to be the stricter of the standards?
Yeah. Have you guys heard of GDPR?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. I figured you had. So, you know, the EU drove the announcement of GDPR back in May, the global data GD privacy requirements. I had to sound it out.
I know.
There.
I have to do the same thing. I do. Yeah.
So, you know, so the way that's being deployed right now, it's based on the IP address of where the data is put into that system. So, you know, it's kind of tough to police right now. Everybody had to sign off in May that they were ready to comply with GDPR standards. But I also think everybody's kind of waiting around to see, you know, how are the EU courts going to address the first violator that gets brought before them, and how serious are the penalties going to be. And so, they've got to be able to adhere to all those GDPR standards. And, you know, even United or American or Delta or Air Canada, even though they're not based in the EU, they operate in the EU. And you look at me, if I'm a United flyer, you know, I may be sitting in a hotel in Munich, but I may be booking on the United website for a flight the following week that I'm going to take between Dallas and New York City. It's a domestic U.S. flight. I'm a U.S. citizen. I'm booking with a U.S. carrier. But because I'm sitting in a hotel in Munich, it's going in through a EU IP address that qualifies for all the restrictions and standards of GDPR. So I think it's really, I think almost everybody's going to have to adapt to GDPR as the lowest common denominator, and kind of be ready to, you know, handle the data within those standards. Because the other thing you look at is, you know, GDPR also requires you within a certain number of hours, if you've had a breach, to notify the customer. And then it goes to the most strictest degree of opt-in and opt-out. You have to literally tell the customer before they put that data into your system how you're going to use that data. And so when you start looking at some of these applications I'm talking about, it just means the fine print in these applications and the policies and all you have to check off accept on, the list is going to get really, really long. But yeah, they're still going to have to meet all those standards, even on this type of stuff. So,
yeah. All right. Well, Greg, before we move on, tell us a little bit about maybe where do you see this going? I mean, I think you've kind of touched on that throughout this discussion, talking about possibilities. But are there bigger or longer term kinds of trends here that you think about?
Yeah, I mean, so a couple of things. We kind of just focused today on the customer experience side of it, and really looking at some of the responsive things that an airline can do to improve the customer experience and be kind of proactive in notifying the customer about things. But you look at connected devices in general, over the next 3 years, we expect the number of connected devices around the world to double. And that's not only mobile devices, but that's Alexa devices and, you know, other home voice-controlled devices and all the sensors on these new aircraft. They just keep adding more and more sensors. Well, that data is being captured, and airlines are starting to save that data, and we're just starting to scratch the surface with how that data can then be pulled in and used in predictive modeling and all types of AI applications to improve the ongoing operating efficiency of an aircraft. And that's almost a whole nother episode to talk about the, yes, the operational and maintenance side. But that's kind of the next big wave, is all these connected devices at airports and on airplanes and things like that. It's capturing terabytes and terabytes of data for every flight. And so there's all types of new applications that can be deployed for how we can use that data to really improve the efficiency and effectiveness of how an airline operates.
Fascinating. Well, Greg, really interesting conversation. Like I said at the beginning, we could talk about a lot of aspects of the areas where you're involved in, but yeah, we'll have to maybe save those for another time.
Sure.
Is there a place online that people can visit somewhere on the IBM website, perhaps, that our listeners can learn more about these things or see more about what IBM is doing in this area?
Yeah, probably the easiest thing to do is go to ibm.com/travel. And that'll take you to a homepage within ibm.com that drills down on all the different travel segments. And I think airline is the very first one. And you can drill down on some of these examples that I talked about today, as well as other examples of use cases and customer references, and then drill down to some of the different solutions and things that we're developing specifically for airlines.
Perfect. Perfect. And do you have a personal online presence that folks might be interested in, Twitter or anything like of that sort?
Sure. Probably the easiest is my Twitter handle is GregLand24. So just GREGLAND24. I try to post a lot of intelligence and white papers and things like that that we're doing, but also other things that pique my interest across the industry. I put those links out there as well. So Twitter's probably the best place to follow me personally and kind of see what I'm up to across the industry.
Great. Greg Land, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
And now we have an airplane of the week from David Vanderhoof. It's been too long, but he's back. Let's see if he remembers how to do it.
Thanks, Max. This aircraft has been on my mind for a couple of weeks now. I wanted to use it for Thanksgiving because its nickname was Turkey. With the passing of President Herbert Walker Bush on Friday, it came to the forefront again. The aircraft was a Grumman TBF Avenger. The TBF, otherwise known as the torpedo bomber Grumman, was designed by Leroy Grumman. The U.S. Navy accepted the design in 1940 as a follow-on to the Douglas TBD Devastator. The TBF was a very Grumman product and took some of its designs from its fighter cousin, the F-4F Wildcat. The TBF was the heaviest single-engine aircraft to operate in World War II. To make it stowable aboard aircraft carriers, Grumman created the stow wing, a.k.a. the Grumman wing fold, where the wings sweep back and fold flush against the fuselage. To this day, the Grumman E-2D Hawkeye, still in production, uses the same wing sweep that began with the Avenger. The TBF was designed around a Wright 2600 twin cyclone, which generated 1,900 horsepower. It was built to carry the Mark 13 torpedo, its weapons base internally. It could also carry 2,000 pounds of bombs. It had a range of 1,000 miles fully loaded with fuel. That and a service ceiling of 30,000 feet made the aircraft perfect for command and control. Originally, the aircraft had a self-defense 30 caliber gun firing through the propeller arc. This eventually was replaced with two 50 caliber, one located in each of the wing before the fold. The improvement was suggested by combat pilots as an improvement to Grumman. A 50 caliber machine gun was also in the ball turret, located in the rear of the large greenhouse canopy. Lastly, a surprise also was a flex-mounted 30 caliber gun that was shot through the ventral stinger. The crew consisted of a pilot, radio man bombardier gunner, and a turret gunner. The TBF was loaded with radio equipment. The hull of the aircraft entered through by a door on the starboard side, and with the whole crew was filled with radio equipment. The cockpit was separate and accessed through a sliding glass canopy. The turret was eventually removed post-war and made more workspace for the TBF. Eventually, the TBF would be used also in the roles of medical evacuation, carrier onboard delivery, air surface warfare, and search and rescue roles. The aircraft was first flown on August 7, 1941. One of the first ex-TBF-1s crashed, however, production continued. The aircraft was given the name Avenger in October of 1941. On December 7, 1941, Grumman rolled the aircraft out in a ceremony showing the aircraft and its new manufacturing plant. Once the ceremony was done, the factory was locked down because of the attack that occurred later that morning by the Imperial Japanese Navy on December 7, 1941, against Pearl Harbor. The TBF would see first blood with VT-8, six early production aircraft supplementing the Devastators for Midway Island. Only one aircraft survived the Battle of Midway. However, their torpedo attack, which allowed the SPD dive bombers to complete their attack mission successfully. The TBF-1C extended its range by incorporating wet wings, or fuel tanks in the wings. By 1943, Grumman phased out production of the aircraft, while Grumman was ramping up full production of the F-6F Hellcat. General Motors Eastern Aircraft Division, located outside Trenton, took over the production of the Wildcat and the Avenger. So how do you teach a car manufacturer to build a torpedo bomber? You build one with sheet screws so you could disassemble and reassemble it, learning how to produce the aircraft. Aircraft built by Eastern would be known as TBMs. There would be eventually more TBMs than actual TBFs. The Avenger would fight in all theaters of World War II and was a subkiller in the North Atlantic. It fought in the Mediterranean as the Royal Navy Taupin. It would also be the Pacific Theater where it would earn its battle stars. An example is September 2, 1944. A TBM-1C took off from the USS San Jacinto, CVL-30. The TBM-1C was Bureau number 46214. The aircraft was part of a flight of four. The crew was Airman Second Class John C. Delaney, gunner, Lieutenant J.G. William G. White, radio operator and bombardier, and the pilot was then Lieutenant J.G. Herbert Walker Bush. The mission immediately received heavy Japanese anti-aircraft fire. 46214 was the third aircraft in the attack. The aircraft's engine was hit in the dive attack on the fortification. In spite of fire and smoke, Bush completed and hit his target. He then flew the stricken aircraft east away from Chichijima. Out at sea, Bush and one of the other crew bailed out of the aircraft. The second crewman's chute did not deploy. The third crewman did not get out of the aircraft. Bush successfully bailed out and was able to deploy his life raft. Fighter protected the pilot until he was picked up by the USS Finback 4 hours later. Of the mission, nine other crew bailed out. Only Bush was successfully recovered. Bush would be given the Distinguished Flying Cross as well as three other air medals for the mission. His unit was awarded the Presidential Unit Citation for his action, and he would fly 58 combat missions at an age of 20 years old. Bush's TBMs were all named Barbara, after his then fiancée, the last being the Barbara III. The USS Herbert Walker Bush, CVN-77, currently at sea, uses the call sign Avenger. So I'll leave it up to everyone if I should go into the next week with more variants and mysteries involved with the Avenger. So ping the geeks at airplanegeeks.com if you want to hear more. So as the former naval aviator would wish people, Kavu, Kavu, Mr. President, fair winds and blue skies. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Oh, nice job, David. Yeah, and that's timely. Boy. I didn't realize, I guess, that so many others had lost their lives at that same mission. Yeah.
He suffered a lot of guilt, especially for the two crew that he lost in his airplane.
Yeah, yeah. What do they call that? Survivor's remorse or something like that?
Survivor's guilt.
Guilt, yes.
And he wanted, he questioned God quite a lot afterwards, that there must have been some higher mission for him to come up. And clearly he did have a lot more to do after his career as a naval aviator.
Yes.
And I'll throw this over to Mr. Trescott. What's CAVU, Mr. Trescott?
Well, CAVU is actually the code word that was used among the family to signal that that George Bush had passed away. But among aviators, it stands for Clear and Visibility Unlimited. And I seem to recall that it had special meaning to the President Bush. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was, you know, something that he used often, I think.
It was his general wish to anyone, especially people who were pilots. Clear skies and visibility unlimited, which is what every pilot wants. So,
All right, David, thanks again. Okay, just a reminder that we have a Bits and Pieces episode coming up at the end of the month, end of December 2018. So if you've got a recording that you'd like to send along, please do that, a story. We've actually received one already from Aaron, who sent in a recording of a memorable flight. So we encourage all of you to think about sending us a recording, a little story, something aviation related, and that's fine. Let's see, Max Trescott, anything going on? Well, of course there is, aviation-wise with you. What's new?
I just wanted to mention my most recent episode on Aviation News Talk, because I particularly enjoyed it and thought others might. It's all about an electrical failure that a doctor had in night IFR, and he thought that he was probably going to die. He texted his son to say goodbye, and then he received a text message from Fort Worth Center, and interviewed the controller who sent that text message. Turns out this particular save got the President's Award this year from NATCA organization. So it's a fun episode, just talking about how text messages were used to save a pilot in that circumstances. And the other thing is, I'm just now, for folks that live in the San Francisco Bay Area, updating and producing my San Francisco Bay Tour map. So this has been something that I've sold locally here for probably a dozen years. And it just shows how to navigate the San Francisco Bay airspace and lists about a dozen different landmarks. It's really beautiful flying around here. You can fly over directly over the Golden Gate Bridge, right next to San Francisco International, go over Alcatraz, and all kinds of sites. So anybody wants one of those, send me a note. Usual place, aviationnewstalk.com. Click contact.
Great. And David, have you got something for us?
I have a bit of a rant.
Uh-oh. I'm nervous.
No, this is actually pretty diplomatic.
Really? Okay.
Yes.
All right.
To all of those journalists out there and airline geeks and who don't understand the military, I just want you to know one thing. There is no such airplane known as Air Force One.
Yes, no specific airplane.
There is no airplane known as Air Force One. The aircraft that carried President Bush from Houston to D.C. was a VC-25, otherwise known as the 747-200. Air Force One is a call sign. When the president is on the airplane, it's Air Force One, but there is no Air Force One. People were shocked that Air Force One was being called SAM 41. SAM stands for Special Air Mission. All aircraft flown out of Andrews in VIP missions are SAM missions, or Special Air Missions. Normally, when the VC-25 went to Houston before it picked up the President Bush, it was known as SAM 28,000. That's the name. That's the call sign of the aircraft, otherwise known as the VC-25. And when they fly President Bush home, they will continue to use the call sign SAM 41. Again, there is no airplane that is a Air Force One. In fact, with all of our current president, he's been flying around in the VC-32. Which is a 757 to all of his things. And when he is aboard, it's Air Force One. So I need to somehow get that communicated out to the general world, and the Air Force needs to do a better job. But there is no such aircraft as Air Force One. There is a VC-25 when the president of the board known as Air Force One, but there is no Air Force One.
Oh, my gosh. This is how I felt when I was told that there was no Santa Claus. I'm crushed. There's no Air Force One?
Oh, dear. No, that's good. Okay, that's good clarification, David. Now I'm going to watch carefully or listen carefully to the press reports and see if they blow that. All right. We'll do a little bit of listener mail. First, Greg, I don't know, do you have any recent aviation-related experiences of note, any particularly wonderful flights or disastrous flights or anything?
Gosh. You know, the thing that's tough for me is almost all the airlines I fly, they're also clients.
Yes.
So I have to be really careful telling bad stories. So
Yeah.
No, for me, probably one of the recent ones I've had that was really very good was I was in Singapore and took the new United 787 Dreamliner from Singapore to LA. And it was my first time to be on that long of a flight on one of those new Dreamliners. And, you know, they say the way it's compressed, the air and stuff, it's supposed to be better for jet lag. And I was very skeptical of that, but I really did notice a difference. I think there's something to be said for what they're trying to do with that aircraft, because now I'm going to Australia later this month, and I'm going to be on the United flight from Houston Intercontinental to Sydney. So that's a 17-hour flight. So that'll be even longer than what I took from Singapore to LAX. So I'll have to test my theory again, but I was pleasantly surprised. It was a lot better than I was expecting.
Nice. Yeah, I have yet to fly on a 787, but would like to do that. You know, Greg, one thing that I was wondering about previously when we were talking is what does the organization at IBM look like as it relates to products and services for airlines, but for aviation in general? Is it
right.
Is it a single unit, or how does that look within IBM?
We're highly matrixed, and so we're organized around industry verticals. So we have an industry vertical for travel and transportation, and within that industry vertical, I lead aviation, hospitality, and travel-related services. I've got a colleague who leads rail, freight and logistics, and kind of that side of the industry. And so we drive kind of the strategy, the point of view, the sales, and the account management within that industry vertical. But then when you look at where the solutions are being developed and delivered, we then have horizontal business units. So like there's a business unit for mobile. There's a business unit for cloud. There's a business unit for data analytics. There's one for Watson for all the AI stuff. So the solutions are actually developed and deployed within those business unit horizontals that crisscross with the industry verticals. So the industry subject matter expertise is in the vertical. The solution expertise is in the horizontal business unit. And the two kind of collaborate together when we're creating these solutions and deploying them to the industry.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Makes sense. Are there employment opportunities in this area? One of the things that that we frequently talk about are jobs in aviation.
Sure.
Is there anything that's possible in IBM these days?
Yeah, sure. I mean, because within the industry vertical, we're always looking to maintain our industry expertise. And both from people that just understand the industry from the business side, as well as people that have hands-on experience with all of the systems. And so so we're always looking for strong, you know, individuals to pull into the industry vertical that actually come from the industry.
Yeah.
When you look at the business unit horizontals, the idea is you want to have the technology subject matter experts coincide with the industry experts. Because Ginny Rometty, our chairman and CEO, she always says, You have to understand an industry to transform an industry. And so we're rolling out these leading edge technologies. So you have to also have the technology expertise for some of these very new technologies. So that's what we try to kind of create, that synergy between the industry experts and then the technology experts in the individual solution areas. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, we're always looking for people from the industry.
Great.
So Greg, you'll get my applicant. You'll get my resume.
Happy to consider it.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's do a couple of listener mails quickly. First, we heard from Chris, and he writes, in episode 528, there was a discussion about TSA pre and global entry. He says, if you live somewhat close to Canada, there's a better deal. Nexus. He said, it's only $50 for 5 years, and it gives you all the benefits of TSA pre and global entry, plus expedited crossing to and from Canada. We'll have a link to the Nexus site. It says there that this program allows pre-screened travelers expedited processing when entering the United States and Canada. Program members use dedicated processing lanes at designated northern border ports of entry, Nexus kiosks when entering Canada by air, and global entry kiosks when entering the United States via Canadian pre-clearance airports. Nexus members also receive expedited processing at marine reporting locations. And then Chris says, you do have to be interviewed by both the U.S. and Canada immigration officials, which would make it more difficult for someone not near the border. Chris says he's in Detroit, and they do both interviews at the same place on the U.S. side of the bridge to Canada. So, and then Chris closes, thanks for the great podcast. So thank you for that information, Chris. Yeah, I wasn't familiar with that Nexus program. Interesting.
No, I wasn't either, and I just looked it up. Turns out that program is administered by Canada, which is kind of interesting. Ah. I just assumed it was a U.S. program, but they say that you've got the same privileges as if you'd registered for global entry. So anyway, I don't know if that $50 is in U.S. money or Canadian dollars. So. That could make a difference.
It could. Probably not a big difference, but I don't know what the rate is these days. All right. And then Rob wrote in, thought this would be of interest for the show. He says, this is from 9news.com.au. Airline Safety, it's titled. Pilot falling asleep over Tasmania reveals problem of cockpit fatigue. And this comes from an incident where a pilot fell asleep. He was in the cockpit off Tasmania. He overflew his landing destination by 46 kilometers. Supposedly, he was an experienced pilot, but he was the only person aboard this Piper PA-31 Navajo Chieftain. He was flying on autopilot, so it, you know, just kind of kept on going. Maybe if there had been another passenger with him, they would have noticed his snoozing. Max T, hopefully you've never fallen asleep flying around in the Cirrus.
No, I'm lucky. I've never fallen asleep in the cockpit. I have heard of other local pilots around here who have fallen asleep, but knock on wood, has not happened to me, and I try to make sure I get enough sleep. You know, that's just one of those things that you kind of do is, besides pre-flying the airplane, it's pre-flight yourself as a pilot. People often use the I'm Safe acronym, of which the F is fatigue. And there's certainly been times when I've thought, nah, I don't think I'll fly today. You know, it just doesn't make sense. But in terms of, self-driving, that's the autopilot, right? And falling asleep. We had a local story here in the Silicon Valley just a few days ago. A guy who lives in the town right next to me in Los Altos was pulled over at 2 or 3 in the morning while he was in his Tesla. And he was asleep at the wheel, literally. And apparently the car was just driving down Highway 101, which is our major thoroughfare here. And the CHP, California Highway Patrol, saw him because he was five miles over the limit. I was about to say 5 knots. Clearly, I spent too much time in airplanes. But he was 5 miles an hour over the limit. And they pulled up next to him and thought, gee, it looks like he's sleeping. So here's how they pulled him over. It was really simple. They just put a car in front of him, and they started slowing down, of course.
Clever.
And the Tesla, yeah, exactly. The Tesla's got the radar adaptive cruise. And so when it sensed a car in front of it slowing down, it's slowed down. They got the car to a halt. The guy was still asleep. They had to bang on the window to wake this guy up. And I guess you probably figured out the rest of the story. Yeah. DUI.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I don't know why this pilot fell asleep in Australia, over Tasmania, but I'm sure they're going to look at that pretty carefully.
See, this is one of the reasons I shouldn't be a pilot, because I fall asleep on airplanes usually before they even pull out of the gate. So this would be very bad.
Yeah, I do too. I can fall asleep sitting in a chair in 5 minutes almost any time of the day.
Hey, airplanes is where I get my best naps.
Yes. So. Yeah, you see all these people sitting around working, you know, trying to get stuff done and everything. And
yeah, what's wrong with those people anyway?
I don't know. I'm asleep because, you know, I'd rather get some sleep ahead of the, you know, the meeting I'm going to have with, you know, with the airline the next morning. I don't want to stay up the whole time. But all right. Well, that is a wrap for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank our guest, Greg Land, IBM Global industry leader, aviation, hospitality, and travel-related services. Greg, again, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you, guys. I enjoyed it. A lot of fun.
You can find us on the web, as always, at airplanegeeks.com. We'll have a shortcut link if you want to go straight to this episode, which is airplanegeeks.com/530. If you want to send us an email, we're at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And you can find all of our other social media places on the website. Let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. And David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
You can find me on Twitter if you can spell Vanderhoof, or you can find me on our Slack listener team. We'd love for you to join that. You can join our private little club by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And, of course, you can listen to that guy and I talk about drones on the UAVDigest.com.
Great. And Max Trescott, how about you?
Well, if you love general aviation, as I do, all those planes that are not military and not airliners, check out Aviation News Talk podcast. And if you want to contact me, go to aviationnewstalk.com and click on contact.
Great. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby at the PaxXPodcast.com. If you want to send me an email, you can reach me at maxflight@airplanegeeks.com. And like David, I'm hanging around the Slack team pretty consistently, so you can find me there. Our outro is by Bruno Masson. Now, Bruno has a new composition, and I've tried to turn it into an outro, and hopefully this works. Hopefully you're hearing it just about now. So I want to thank Bruno for that. You can find more of his work at brunomassone.com. That's Bruno, B-R-U-N-O, and Massone is M-I-S-O-N-N-E.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.
Ladies and gentlemen, in a few moments, we shall be landing. Kindly observe.
So, Greg, you can switch to just audio. You can turn the video off. We'll
Okay. I wasn't sure if you guys were trying to do video or not.
So. Yeah. No.
There we go.
Yeah, we're face for radio and all that.
It's minimal bandwidth strategy.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Which actually improves the audio a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
Because we don't have to look at each other.
Many of our guests stick with us for the rest of the show. Some jump in and participate in other conversations. And
some eventually become hosts on the show as well.
And some become hosts.
We just can't get rid of me.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Oh, you're fine, though. I'm wondering who's being arrested. I hear all the sirens.
I know.
Oh, sorry. That's the benefit of living in Manhattan. I'm on the 20th floor, and yet I still hear sirens and honking cars go by. So sorry about that.
That's all right.
I used to live in New York, so I totally get it.
Yeah. As long as they're not going to your place, that's fine.
I don't think so, but you know, they could still be making their way up to the 20th floor. So yeah.
Come out with your hands up. Yeah.
You never know here in Manhattan, right?
Well, that would be a first for the podcast.
Live. Our guest host gets arrested live on the podcast.
Yeah.